I think in medicine, it's so messy that I think the things that we have to teach politicians are to be thoughtful and careful about the degree to which politics dominates the fundamental aspects of patient care and human health.
Bob Wachter, physician and professor of medicine at UCSF, is the author of Digital Doctor, a wonderful new book describing what happens when irresistible technology meets an immovable medical system. Today we'll learn how a nice boy from Long Island with a major in poli-sci wound up in a place like this.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm Lisa Soonan.
And I'm David Chaywitz.
I noticed that someone wrote in my chart that I was difficult. And I have to tell you, I remember that appointment exactly. You see, this nurse had asked me to put a gown on, but it was a mole on my shoulder. And actually, I'd specifically worn a tank top so that I wouldn't have to put a gown on. You know, they're made of paper.
Well, that was a long time ago. How about if I just erase it? Now, about that rash.
But it was in pen. You fake erase.
All right, Miss Venice. This doesn't look too serious. You should be fine.
What are you writing?
So, Bob, I know you're a huge fan of Seinfeld. I think you even named your dog Newman.
That is correct.
And you quote this scene in your book to highlight an important evolving aspect of EMRs. Why did this scene seem particularly topical to you?
You know, it's so interesting that medicine has kind of divided the world of doctors and patients into two camps. And in some ways, you know, and from the very beginning of medicine, we use our own language, and it's kind of a secret society, and patients are on the other end of the, on the other side of the curtain. And one of the things that I find most interesting about our world finally and reluctantly going digital is all of those boundaries are going to be tested. And in ways that I think are very exciting, carry unbelievably wonderful potential for patient involvement and engagement, but also fraught with all kinds of hazards. And that was the start of a chapter that I have on open notes, the idea that patients will be able to see their own notes. Because as you well know, for the last 20 years, patients have had a right to see their notes, but when the note is on paper, that right is really quite, it's a false promise. They really have no easy access to it. Now what patients need is a password. And so all of these boundaries that we've traditionally erected in medicine are going to be broken down. And I think one of the things we've learned over the last few years is it's really complicated. The side effects of that, these new models are different than anybody anticipated.
You know, Bob, there's, you know, in the United States, I think there's only one state, I'm pretty sure it's New Hampshire, where patients legally own their own medical records. In every other state, it's owned by somebody else, the hospital, the EMR, the whoever. And even though patients can get their records, it's very, very difficult. Do you think this is going to change? Does it take regulation at the national level to change this and make that data the patient's?
I'm not sure how ownership is going to go, but I think ownership's actually not going to be that important in the future, Lisa. I think what's going to happen is that there's going to be one electronic medical record, and patients will have complete full access to it, because, you know, how are you going to stop that tide? That once it's an electronic database and all the patient needs is a password, and you're now in a market where for a hospital or a health system, patients will say, what do you mean I can't have access to my record if I see you, primary care doctor, you health system, you know, A, I'm going to go across town to B where they treat me as a person. And so I think the competitive market is going to speak here, and patients will have full access to their record. I don't think that's even going to be the most interesting question. I think you get then into real questions about what the record consists of and how it gets constructed and what you do with data that comes from patients, because there sometimes is conflict. If I'm going to see a patient, you know, in the office, and I ask the question of a patient, I'm interpreting their answer and I'm writing it down or typing it into my electronic record. What if the patient disagrees with that, as I think the Seinfeld case brings up? You know, who wins? You might say, well, of course the patient should win because it's the patient's record and it's all about the patient. But there will be times where that's actually a tricky question, where the doctor or another health professional is making some judgments that have some clinical import and that the patient may have limited insight into. So I think this brings up challenges that we just haven't really fully worked through. But I think patients are going to all have.
I mean, you have an interesting example of this in your book, where the physician thinks the patient essentially is an alcoholic, but is concerned. Is that the guy is like, I think works in the printing business, and the question is, oh, if you mention it in the context of open notes, how do you broach that discussion with the patient who's going to read it, and then you sort of describe a very positive outcome of that. But you can imagine that conversation also going sideways.
Right. And I think that's, no two patients are alike. And for one patient, the information that I might write down in his or her note about their prognosis will be something they absolutely want full access to. They want to know that this disease is really quite terrible, and here's the number of months that I think they have left and all that kind of stuff. For another patient, that would be devastating and immoral to share with that patient, because the patient does not want to know that. So what does the doctor do in terms of writing his or her note when that information may be something that's quite important for another physician or another healthcare provider to see? These are just, these are not insurmountable issues, but when there was this massive divide between the world of the doctor and the world of the patient, it was a lot simpler. And now that those worlds are going to morph together in ways that are happening very quickly, it becomes more fraught, more unpredictable, and I think the chance for misunderstanding grows considerably.
So, Bob, I just want to take a step back. So, I think most in our audience realizes you're a professor at UCSF. You're really the founder of the hospitalist movement. You're author, as we will say earlier in the introduction, of The Digital Doctor, a wonderful new book about what happens when technology hits healthcare. But we want to know how you got started in this, Rock. I want you to take us back to your childhood on Long Island as a... First of all, North Shore or South Shore? The people want to know.
North Shore. I my first 7 years on the South Shore, then the next 10 on the North Shore, a town called Woodbury on the border of Nassau and Suffolk County, a pretty dull suburban existence.
Which has the best parties, the North Shore or the South Shore, then?
Well, Buttafuoco and Amy Fisher, the South Shore. South Shore?
They're all pretty much the same. It's a New York bedroom community. My father ran a small business in Manhattan, had an hour and 15-minute commute to work each day, so that was important to me in recognizing that I wanted to live 10 minutes from work. Neither of my parents went to college, which I think was quite important. So they, having their kids get a really good education was very, very important. I'd say my most decisive influences were the fact that I fell in love with politics and policy in high school, partly because it was the Watergate era, and decided I wanted to be a doctor, and it wasn't clear how those two things would jive. I was a political science major when I went to college at Penn, and had this sort of weird feeling that somehow I would figure out a way of taking this part of my brain that liked thinking about systems and politics and how people organize themselves, and the rest of my brain that really wanted to be a doctor, and somehow would morph together. I didn't have any idea what that would look like. And you can explain my career as what happens when a political science major becomes a modestly successful academic physician.
Well, there must be some sort of DNA pathway, or that goes from poli sci to healthcare, because that's my pathway too. I also have
a
master's in political science. And although I see the connection as being totally devoid of logic, two fields totally devoid of logic and full of arguing. So I don't know that they're so far afield.
I think there's tremendous logic in it. And one of the things that's so interesting about the era that we find ourselves in is I think that logic has become clear. I think the reason it felt illogical when I was training, and I think I'm probably older than you, so different eras, was that physicians did not approach healthcare as being a system. We approach healthcare as being kind of this mom and shop business, and the role of a doctor was to be the smartest doctor he or she could be, have a lot of stuff stuck between his or her ears, and provide great clinical care and great technical care. We didn't think of what we were doing as being part of this enormous, unbelievably complex ecosystem that had political aspects, ethical aspects, sociological aspects, cultural aspects. And I think, the patient safety movement 15 years ago, and over the last 10 or 15 years, the broader movement toward value has told us that, healthcare is anything but that. Yes, you have to be a really good doctor in the traditional sense, but the outcomes of patients are to a very large degree determined by how well the system works. And I learned more about thinking about creating functional systems in my poli-sci major than anything I ever learned in med school. So I think we've learned that there's actually quite a substantial Venn diagram there.
Well, it's been interesting over the past, you know, let's call it 10 years, that maybe eight, that there's been so much talk of healthcare in the political discourse. I mean, it's been the major focus of so much political debate. Do you think that the political system can create a better healthcare system? Has it through Obamacare or no? They should stay apart from each other.
Yeah, you know, I think that you can't. I remember during the run up to Clinton Care, you had some of a few of the debates, some of the candidates said things like, "Keep government out of my Medicare." and sitting there listening, I'd say, "Who exactly do they think is Medicare?"
Exactly,
that's among the more ludicrous statements that you'll ever hear. So, you know, government pays for half of the health care in the United States. It will always be so, if not more. And so, and we're talking about 18% of the gross domestic product. We're talking about something that people care about deeply, that has to have a huge regulatory framework, no matter what you think about regulation in general. And so politics is always going to have a role in the way healthcare is organized and delivered. It's just too important, and there's too much money involved for it not to be there. And the question always is, what is the appropriate role? And you want government to be doing as much as it needs to do to get the job done and not a thing more. And of course, you know, if you approach that from the right or the left, you have very different views of coming into it as to what those things are. Personally, I have a deep belief that left to its own devices, as many of my colleague doctors would want, you know, dialing back the clock to the year of Marcus Welby and let doctors practice medicine the ways they want to practice, put us in an environment where we had demonstrably unreliable care, low patient safety, relatively poor access, and costs that are bankrupting our society. I think that was the result of a hands-off approach. And so I believe that government has an important role to play in trying to guide the system toward a set of incentives and a structure that will deliver better, higher quality, more reliable, safer care at a lower cost. Now, I'll be the first one to say that if the government gets it wrong or takes on too exuberant a regulatory mindset, they will screw it up. And there are clearly times where we're seeing that. But I think the idea of just leave us alone, we can get this right on our own, I think the evidence would say that's not the correct stance.
But why is there such affection then, which I think in some cases, I mean, to all of us share to some degree, for the individual practitioner? I think we both read the recent Charles Krauthammer piece where you know, he emphasized about how, you know, the individual practitioner is disappearing, and there is something that's incredibly, not just sort of romantic about it, but where, you know, the physician who really knows, who isn't just part of the system. So you sort of have like the Cheesecake Factory view of medicine, which sort of a lot of population health, a lot of poli-sci people seem to like. But then, and the funny thing is, I feel like you so get viscerally both sides of this, you know, sort of the whole population health, here's the system, here's what we should do to take care of the most people in the most efficient way. But then there's just sort of the laying on of the hands and the individual caring, which seems more matched to sort of the individual practitioner, the almost this old school model. How do you sort of balance those two perspectives?
Really, as if that really existed.
Well, I struggle with that a lot because, and I think the question is, do those ideas really compete with each other as much as the advocates of one side or the other make it seem? And I guess I can see a path toward a future in which people see an individual doctor who is completely dedicated to them, who is looking them in the eye, who cares deeply about them and their family and their context and their preferences, but who is embedded in something of a system that takes care of a lot of the business, that ensures that when the patient needs to leave that, you know, even the patient who loves their family doctor doesn't say, you know, I need a heart bypass operation. Why don't you do it? Because I think you're really a terrific person. I mean, they, you know, or say, I'm going to go to the ER and I'll just sit here and wait for you to show up. I mean, going to have to see different doctors, different team members, and it's got to be woven together correctly. So I guess I'm optimistic enough that I can see a future system where patients feel like they're getting the personal care of the individual physician, but that physician is existing in a team system and a digital system that weaves the elements together to provide the best care at the lowest cost.
Well, the digital system is so interesting as it's evolving. And, you know, I think so much effort is going on the entrepreneurial side to push the care to the patient in the home, you know, digital diagnostics, digital therapeutics in the home. How much can we do on our own with do-it-yourself medicine? And yet the physicians and the health systems are really still getting paid primarily on volume, not value, if we're really honest with ourselves. How does that transition work? How do the doctors feel about that, really, when they're alone in the coffee room, you know?
Hey, at least you didn't say on the golf course.
Or on the golf course at the Tesla dealership.
There's a huge amount of skepticism.
That's where the VCs go.
There is a general feeling among many physicians, even physicians, I believe, like me, who believe that having the physician up on the pedestal and being a demigod and you know, Dr. House kind of model of the arrogant, nasty physician is wrong, completely wrong. That patients should be empowered, should have as much access to information as they can, and should be in a position to make all of the decisions that they're comfortable with. Even people who believe that, I guess I'll personalize this, I believe that that the idea that patients will be able to largely or completely self-manage is mostly hype. And that doesn't mean that the people pushing that idea are completely wrong, because I think maybe if we live long enough, I mean, there were people who thought that managing your own finances or making your own plane reservation was also hype probably 20 or 30 years ago, and we see that those things have come true. So they may come true eventually. But I think there are fundamental differences in healthcare. I think the degree to which learning that you might have a diagnosis or have a scary symptoms is extraordinarily anxiety provoking is different than many other walks of life, like including managing your finances or managing your travel. I think that, you know, if you look up on the web, I'll tell you a story. My younger son called me a couple weeks ago, and he's a reasonably self-sufficient young adult. And he said, I have diabetes and I have glaucoma. And I said, what makes you think that? And he told me his symptoms. And of course, he looked it up on WebMD, and that's what he said he had. And I said, Benji, you don't have diabetes and you don't have glaucoma. But he was trying to self-manage. And I think that the trick here, you know, the big game here that we're all hunting for is how do we create a healthcare system that gives patients what they need and want, which is high quality, safe care at a cost that doesn't bankrupt either patients or society. To the degree that patients can safely self-manage and they want to do that, and we can build tools that allow them to do that, that's fabulous. I think that's wonderful. Let's try to do that. To the degree that patients are being sort of pushed toward that end because of high copays, because of high deductibles, and because of companies that are hyping the things that patients can do on their own, I think that's potentially a problem and may push patients too hard in this direction.
So, you know, one of the things that you've always talked about is how much medical care is delivered, you know, wastefully, excessively, and how, you know, not good that is. And, you know, one of the things I'm worried about is we're going to resurrect that problem if we drive all the digital diagnostics to the home, that patients are going to obsessively test, leading to obsessive overtreatment once again. Is that something that concerns you?
It's not high on my list of concerns, because I think it the same movement that will drive all of this activity to the home is going to be linked to a dialing down of the degree to which insurance covers it. So I think you have sort of competing, you have trends that are kind of woven together in ways that are still hard to completely disentangle. But, you know, you have to recognize that some of the movement toward patients being able to be, you know, do self-doctoring is linked to a movement to not have first dollar insurance coverage for everything.
Sure.
And so, you know, patients at home, they can do whatever they want at home, but the question is insurance going to pay for it? I don't think that it's likely that patients are going to have access to all of these newfangled tests at home and that insurance is going to pay for the first dollar of testing. So that will force patients to be thoughtful about whether they really do need this test. And I think you sort of end up almost in the same place, which is to say patients may have access to home blood testing and home, you know, retinal scanning and home sensors and all that, But at the end of the day, they are still not going to be the same kind of experts that someone who went to school for 10 years is going to be. And the insurance system is probably going to say, if you want this thing to be covered, there needs to be a credentialed expert who weighs in and says, this is an appropriate thing for you to be doing.
Yeah, I think we're going to end up needing a person at the doctor's office who screens the calls from all the people continuously monitoring their heart functions, their blood, you know, pressure.
Well, I think that's
else.
Right. I mean, you know, I've heard, you hear this periodically, you know, that people are going to have sensors and it's going to be monitoring their heart rate and their stress level. And that all of that data is going to flow wirelessly to the primary care doctor who somehow is going to welcome it. And when I hear stuff like that, I say, you know, every primary care doctor I know, if they get one more piece of data, they're going to kill themselves.
Yeah.
And, like, how is that going to work? So my own analogy that I've been using is that is of the Transcontinental Railroad, which is that finally and largely because of the federal incentives, in the last 5 years, hospitals and doctors' offices, sort of the institutions of medicine, have gone digital. And that's sort of the tracks being built out from one coast. At the same time, now you have Apple and Google and all the sensor companies building out another railroad from the other coast, which is essentially patient-oriented digital medicine with patients being able to self-manage. And at some point, somebody's going to have to lay the golden spike that is going to weave these two tracks together and then analyze, you know, take this new data stream that's holistic across the patient's continuum of care and make sense of it. And I don't think anybody knows who that's going to be. I don't see an existing company that owns that space. Whoever comes in there and can manage that, I think may win the game in terms of being a truly crucial part of the healthcare ecosystem.
So the figures out how to say, just to restate that, you think that the sort of the key missing piece, and there was an interesting essay, because someone wrote about this in the context of genetics, that said, oh, this killer sort of application, this killer component that's missing.
And I don't know that killer is the best adjective in the
medical
context.
Yeah, we'll try a different word, but go ahead.
I just wanted you to try to crystallize that again.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this is pretty far off in the horizon. But what I do see is that once we get past this initial stage of digitizing the basic processes in a doctor's office and in a hospital, and once we get past the basic stages of patients being able to have information at their fingertips and generate information from surveys or from sensors, you now have a new big data problem, which is a ton of data that relates to the entirety of a patient's existence. And then, of course, layering into that, the work that you do, David, which is, you know, the genetic piece of that, where does that all fit in? And now you have an immense amount of data on every patient. And at the same time, of course, the medical literature is continuing to produce a few thousand articles a day. Some entity is going to have to take all that, synthesize it, and then present it back to both patients and whatever the caregivers of the future look like to help them make good decisions.
So I think that what you're describing is really what many folks recognize as sort of the larger ambition, a sort of integrated health data set, whether it's the precision medicine initiative, the cohort they're trying to build, whether it's cohorts that are being trying to be built by some academic centers, by some companies like HLI. I think everyone shares your passion for this and realizes that there's some value to be had, and also that it's non-trivial to extract that.
I think that, but I guess I'd clarify one thing. I think the vision of creating this humongous data set from which knowledge can be gleaned is one part of the problem and the promise, because that data set, you could envision there being a company that sort of takes all that data, sifts through it, sort of the analog of what the NSA is doing right with all of our phone data, and comes up with insights about how to best manage patients with Crohn's disease. There's a second layer of that, which is, how do I take, you know, what happens to Mrs. Jones today when she has belly pain? And that's not the same problem. They're linked, obviously, but they have a different flavor.
So in this world of data, I mean, when the data's flying around everywhere from consumer products to healthcare systems, does privacy matter to people anymore? Do they actually care about that?
Well, I think the evidence seems to say that they care less than some people think they should. It does appear that people are willing to give up a lot of what we used to think of as core privacy issues in order to get, you know, targeted ads to them so they can shop better. You know, not even getting into the healthcare space. But you know, then when there's a breach, I think you see people are quite worried about that. It doesn't appear, you know, it's interesting because privacy is one of those issues in many ways, like gun control and others, where a relatively small number of people are incredibly passionate about it, and they tend to win the debate. And I think that, you know, then becomes an interesting political problem. What do you do if 90% of the people say, you know, it's not that important to me. I'd rather have really convenient care with my data moving around in the ways that allow that to happen. But 5 or 10% of people feel strongly about it. And, you know, who knows? It's interesting to see, you know, when I talk to experts on interoperability, they all say, you know, we could get pretty far along in this debate if everybody had a uniform, universal patient identifier. If we knew who everybody was with a single number, that fixes a lot of the problems with interoperability. But there are a relatively small number of very passionate privacy advocates, and I don't question their motives, who are frantically worried about that and who think if that happens, all sorts of pernicious secondary effects would occur and have gotten in the way of that happening, which makes this a much more difficult nut to crack.
I mean, you definitely kind of wonder what's going to happen first, whether there's going to be sort of some kind of terrible breach, health-related breach, you know, that sort of moves people in one direction, or whether we're really going to sort of finally reach the tipping point in the other where collecting all of this health data, people who are able to, who are openly share, who agree to share, you're able to reach the point where you really benefit, clearly benefit, not like, oh, here, it's a vague good that you're doing by sharing data, but it'll be more conspicuous what the benefit of more richly sharing data is. And I'm a strong believer in that will become apparent, but I think that you sort of really need the killer case.
The problem, though, I think is a media problem and the amplifier effect of the single case. You know, as Stalin said, a single death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic. The fact that many people are benefiting in a mild but important way from a certain kind of sharing of data, but then one visible, iconic case of something terrible happening, that latter tends to trump the former in the political debate.
So I want to switch gears just briefly to ask you a question about your wonderful book.
Thank you.
On page 95, to be specific, when you're speaking with MIT professor Andy McAfee and noted VC Vinod Khosla, you say you felt a, quote, a strange obligation to stick up for my teams, humans and the subset of humans called doctors. I was thinking that this is what's so distinctive about your book, that while some of the writing on digital health is focused on the entrepreneurs or the technologies, and of course it's always the name of the patients, you're unabashedly focused on the doctors. Help us understand what you mean by that.
Well, in that particular context, it was really, you know, this feeling like every human profession is going to be ultimately taken over by the machines, and I think there is this tendency, if you've trained for as many years as we have to become a doctor, to say there's something pretty, I must have learned something during all of that that is feels unique and special, and therefore, if it is taken over, first of all, I think it's going to be hard to completely take over what I've learned. But second of all, there are some downsides to that. So, you know, I try to write the book as honestly as I could, and not, you know, it was impossible for me to throw away the idea that I come at this from being a physician for 30 years, and that is my worldview. I tried to, you know, when I decided to write the book, my wife, who's a journalist, says you have to do this as a journalist, which meant I went in with very open eyes and interviewed a lot of people really as a journalist, in part because I was not an expert in IT, and I think it was good that I wasn't. So I came in with a fairly open agenda without a preconceived notion about why this wasn't working as well as I would have hoped. But there was no question that I see the world through the lens of a doctor, and I kind of like that. I mean, what it meant, as opposed to seeing the world through the lens of a technologist, for example, or an entrepreneur, I know what it's like taking care of someone where we've just made a diagnosis of cancer and I'm telling them that you have a fatal disease. I know what it's like taking care of a patient who is, you know, who was fine 2 minutes ago and now is on the throes of death. And I know what it's like trying to make a very, very tough diagnosis when I have 500 facts I'm trying to sift them through to come up with the salient 7 facts I'm trying to explain. I think if you don't know what those things are like, I think the idea of replacing doctors with computers would seem like a reasonably easy thing to do once you've seen the Google car or once you saw Watson beat Jeopardy. I think, you know, that point of view made me sort of circumspect about how easy it is or to replace doctors with technology or what some of the consequences might be. And I quite clearly worry about losing some of the human dimensions of the doctor-patient relationship.
So if you take a step back again to your political background or political interests anyway, what could the politicians that we're now hearing from, you know, a new one launching their campaign every day, what could they learn from the healthcare system? What could the doctors teach them about how to do something better?
Oh, geez. I think the healthcare system is not a model in terms of the way we have organized ourselves. But I do think that one of the things that the healthcare system poses all the time is this sort of tension between a kind of reductionist view of the world of, you know, here are people and dollars and processes and techniques and research, and we can kind of sit around a conference table, look at some PowerPoint slides, and kind of figure out the right thing to do and then legislate it. That sounds right, and probably in certain walks of life, it probably works out okay. I think in medicine, it's so messy. The human dimensions of what we do and the ethical issues of what we do are so extraordinarily complex that I think the things that we have to teach politicians are not to leave us alone, which a lot of doctors say, because I think they can't and they shouldn't, but to be thoughtful and careful about the degree to which politics dominates the fundamental aspects of patient care and human health. They can get it wrong in two directions, and I think they in the past often have gotten it wrong by leaving us alone. And by that I mean not creating a set of incentives and conditions that drive us toward providing the best care at the lowest cost. I think left to our own devices, despite having very well-meaning, well-trained doctors and nurses, we will not do that because the systematic aspects of that are very hard. So I don't think we should be left alone, but I think we should be given a set of incentives and conditions that drive us to producing the best outcomes at the lowest cost. But when politics gets too deeply into the weeds of the doctor-patient relationship or how we use our technology tools, I think they often will screw it up. And I think that's part of what we've seen in the last couple of years in terms of the digital transformation.
So we're almost done, but one of the interesting questions that always comes up is, in a lot of the health economic stuff, is are doctors different? And, you know, there's a huge school of thought that says, you know, the key thing is recognizing that doctors aren't really that different than anybody else and need to be treated like they're not. I think Lisa might agree with that.
Everybody's an economic being and an emotional being at their core,
yeah.
I think.
But what I'm hearing from you from you is that really, and it actually resonates probably with my worldview and certainly with my experience, that there really is something that does seem distinctive and special about being a physician, about taking care of patients, and about, just like you're saying, being in that moment that, you know, on the one hand, like it seems like hard to, you know, and like maybe it's medicine at its best, but that really does feel special and distinctive and important and worth preserving.
I think so. You know, I when I say that, I also have to recognize that every profession is socialized into thinking that they are special and therefore biased. So
Lisa's providing that perspective here.
I'm glad you guys feel so
Lisa,
special.
You know, I took health economics courses at Stanford during my fellowship and saw a lot of very smart people who basically approach medicine in the exact same economic way as everything else, and doctors are economic animals, and if you pay them more for X and less for Y, they'll do more of X and less of Y.
Yeah, we heard that from Bob Kocher as well.
You know, yeah, there's some of that that's true and some of that that's wrong. And you know, like most complicated questions in life, the answer will be somewhere in between the poles. And the answer is empiric. It's not like
right.
I can convince you that I'm right or you're wrong. The truth will be that we have to use incentives to drive us and the system to do some things very differently than we've all been brought up to do them. But the consequences of treating doctors as purely economic animals, I think, are quite negative, and we're beginning to see that. And I think I think we're seeing that in other professions as well. It's not just medicine.
Right.
That if you drive people to sort of, if you purge professionalism and self-motivation and purpose from their work life, then you get a bunch of, you know, people sort of building widgets, but no longer being the innovators and improvers that you really want them to be.
You know, Bob, I feel like you've always managed to be at the intersection of such of of such complex debate, and that you're always able to bring and bring the debate and infuse it with such incredible warmth and humanism and nuance and common sense. And we're so deeply grateful. Well, one, to that you wrote this wonderful book, and two, that you spent some time with us this today on the podcast. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And for
you're
your
very kind.
And for your really for your ongoing contribution on social media and everywhere else to sort of being so often, it seems like, the voice of reason in what can sometimes be almost gratuitously contentious debates.
Good talking to you, Bob. Thank you so much.
We all want the same thing. Thanks so much. I really appreciate
it. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.